Namaste. Hello, I'm Shannon Letty. Welcome to episode 3 of The Situation of Education, which we're calling Indigenizing Science Education. When I teach classes on Indigenous education, we cover a lot of topics under 3 main themes: decolonization, reconciliation, and self-determination. Often, this material is new for students because we're still working with the generations of Canadians who received little or no education about Indigenous peoples when they were in the K-12 school system. Most students are open to this new learning, but there are a few concepts that present a struggle. One of them is the concept of Indigenous science. Early in the term, I introduced students to the idea that Western and Indigenous thinking are rooted in 2 different ontologies, or 2 different ways of considering our realities. To illustrate this, I draw a triangle on one part of the board. Yes, on the board. I like to get all old school in the classroom. And then I draw a circle on another part of it. I suggest to students that the triangle represents the Western understanding of how all of the creatures in the world fit together. And then I ask them to consider what might be at the top. And they always know the answer to that. It's humans, of course. And underneath the humans are arranged all of the other creatures in creation, often in subconscious categories, such as animals we like as pets, animals we like to eat, animals that like to eat us, birds, fish, all the way down to, say, for example, the things that live on us, which we'd prefer not to think about. I then suggest that the circle represents an Indigenous perspective on all of the creatures in the Western that fit into the Western hierarchy. They fit into the circle in a holographic web of interrelationships in which no singular species dominates. They may not take in all of the implications of this difference at first go, but students generally get the concept. When later in the term we begin to talk about Indigenous science, there's often some confusion expressed about exactly what that means. Those who have studied the sciences in the formal sense prior to entering the Bachelor of Education program are sometimes concerned that Indigenous science means a rejection of Western science and scientific thinking, or a conflation of spiritualism and Indigenous medicines with science or pseudoscience. While they may be right about some aspects of that, not the pseudoscience part, their concerns over the rejection of Western science are needless. Indigenous knowledges are arrived at in precisely the same way that Western knowledges are arrived at. Observation, experimentation, investigation, comparison, classification, all of these are elements that inform Indigenous knowledge, which means they all inform Indigenous views of science and scientific thinking as well. I offer readings and other resources throughout the term to help flesh out students' understanding, but I often wish they'd been taught science in a more holistic way that would make clearer how these 2 ontologies and their related epistemologies, or ways of gathering information, overlap. To get a clearer picture of what this might look like, I turned to a Nehiyaw Cree friend of mine who is working on just that problem as part of her graduate work at Simon Fraser University. Lindsay Heller began her professional life as a research scientist at a drug development company on UBC campus. But her own developing sense of herself as a Cree woman and her sense of herself as a Western scientist urged her to push deeper into exactly what holding these 2 identities simultaneously means. So I'm here with Lindsay, who has kindly offered to come and speak with us about Indigenizing science education. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
So my first question is my usual first question. What drew you into your work as a research scientist?
I think, you know, going through elementary school and high school, science was always treated as the truth. You know, you could, in art class or in English class, you know, writing poetry, there was, you know, an element of you know, different things could be right. You could be graded, you know, for creativity. And in the science that I was, you know, exposed to and, dare I say, indoctrinated into, it was the truth. It was, you know, this is the way, this is how you do it, and this is, there's no There's no question about it. And so, you know, I was good at science, in high school, and decided to take that path in post-secondary. So I went to UBC and did a genetics degree. And, you know, I found it interesting. I was learning something new all the time. But there was always that quest for truth. And I was never exposed to anything different. And so I think, you know, with research science, it was a good job. It was a well-respected job. And I knew what the expectation was. I knew the rules of science, and Right. It was, you know, it was that quest for truth, and that's kind of how it happened for me.
Hmm. So it's because we know science is rooted in positivism, that idea that there is a singular truth.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
sounds like that was the initial appeal to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made
solid.
Sense to me. Yeah,
yeah.
It's like, okay, if I follow these rules and follow these protocols and analyze this data in a very specific way, then I would come to the truth.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's big business. It was, you know, I always would have a job, you know, and I'm not trying to slam it. I really enjoyed a lot of the work, but it was always just that one single quest for truth, and that's kind of what what appealed to me. I knew how to think that way. That was the way I had always that was the only way that there was no alternative. And so I was successful at it, and you know, was fortunate enough to get some good opportunities, and kind of went with it.
So, but now as you've sort of grown and matured, you've mm-hmm. developed a stronger relationship with your Cree culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how that's informed your understanding of science.
I think it's probably changed everything.
Hmm.
I didn't always have that exposure to my culture, being adopted and being raised outside of my culture. In school, there was never any counter narrative to that, Eurocentric style of science. It just didn't even exist. It's not like I even knew I was missing anything. And so as I began to make those connections and, you know, find my family and find my community, it's really changed, my understanding of what science is.
Right.
Yeah.
And could you describe that sort of change, or what your new perspective entails?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, it's not like as I, you know, began going to ceremony or, you know, sitting with elders and hearing stories, it's not like there was, you know, one story that was like, this explains what Indigenous knowledge is, or this explains science. It's, you know, it's been a long, very much ongoing process of those experiences and of those conversations that have really encouraged me and allowed me to look at the world in a very different place. And it's allowed me to create a counter narrative to that idea of ownership,
right,
of human dominion over everything. And so in those ceremonies, in Sweat Lodge, in those conversations that I've had, and experiences that I've had, it's really allowed me to understand that there's a different way to look at the world, and that fundamental piece of the, you know, an Indigenous paradigm is that idea of connectedness and kinship. You know, there's even a word in the Cree language that describes that really doesn't exist in the English language. And that word is Wakotoan. That doesn't exist in the English language. And it really is a set of kinship laws that govern us as, you know, arguably Indigenous people, but, you know, specifically as Nehiyawa Cree people. And it's not just kinship, you know, how you think of it in that Western term, you know, my brother, my sister, my grandmother. It's a deep connection and respect for everything. And so it's provided me a way of looking at my surroundings, looking at other people around me, looking at the land, looking at the animals, looking at the plants, that have really changed my my understanding of science. You know, so the fact that there's a word in our language that describes that, there isn't that in the English language. And that deep connectedness and that deep respect and reciprocity is something that is, you know, missing from the Eurocentric idea of science. Mm-hmm. And I think that if that paradigm, if that approach can be, you know, understood better, respected, and actually incorporated, I think a lot of the ecological crises that we see nowadays that are really just being tackled from that Eurocentric science point of view, if there was an ability or, you know, like I said, a respect and understanding of an alternative and complementary approach, those crises could be, you know, we talk about this idea of two-eyed seeing. These crises can be approached with two different paradigms.
Right.
And, you know, where something in Western science may lack, that's where the indigenous science and that way of looking at the world, you know, can come in and complement that, and vice versa, where there's things that are lacking in an indigenous science, you know, kind of paradigm, then Western science can complement that.
I think that's such an important point. And I, in the introduction to this episode, I talked a little bit about how I teach these concepts to students. And I described that I often draw a circle and a triangle on the mm-hmm. board. And in the triangular version of the world, which is the Western version, human beings are at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And in the circular version of the world, there's an interrelated web of connections.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, sometimes when we talk to students, they end up feeling like, well, Western science is completely different from Indigenous science.
Mm-hmm.
But when I hear you speak, and the reason that I wanted to, mm-hmm. to speak to you on the program, mm-hmm. You know, I recognize that that's not true, that mm-hmm. there are a lot of crossovers.
Absolutely.
And I know that a lot of work that you've done in this area is leading to being able to explain that and define it more clearly,
mm-hmm.
perhaps as a Venn diagram rather than as just,
yeah.
you know, a compare and contrast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think the two paradigms are complementary.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need to, they're not in competition with each other. It's, you know, it's two different ways of viewing the world. And, you know, one typically comes from a place of ownership and dominion and that seeking of truth. And, you know, if we can seek that truth and find that truth, we own that truth. And, you know, when you're coming from an indigenous paradigm, there is no ownership. Everybody owns everything.
Right.
That knowledge isn't, you know, for the betterment of me or my company. The acknowledgement is for the betterment of everyone and everything. And again, I think that's the piece that's lacking from Eurocentric science. You know, it's built upon, you know, you read in the Bible, you know, humans have dominion over everything.
Right.
And, you know, that hasn't worked so well for us.
Not particularly.
And you know, and I feel like, you know, one doesn't exclude the other. They can work together. And there is definitely a lot of crossover. And I think that if both of these approaches and understandings of science can work together, you know, I think the world would be a lot better place, actually. Yeah.
I tend to agree with you. I think it's, I've always thought it funny about Western science that we seem to think that we can, you know, break things down into their constituent
mm-hmm.
parts or, you know, just look at, say, we're looking at mineral extraction, just
mm-hmm.
look at geological factors without considering, well, what is happening to the plants and
yeah.
the animals and the water
yeah.
and the air
yeah.
in that region. So this
yeah.
holistic perspective,
yeah.
I think enlivens Western science
yeah,
and
absolutely.
Just gets us to consider more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So my final question for you, because we've already sort of talked about the difference between these two paradigms,
mm-hmm.
but I'm curious, especially as you move forward in your research, how do you want to see science education change in order to accommodate both ways of knowing? And you've got kids in school,
I
so
do.
You've really got a pony in this
yeah,
race, too.
I definitely do.
Yeah.
this is something I've thought a lot about, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, in my scholastic career, up until very recently, there was never any kind of Indigenous content. You know, and I would have, as an adopted person, desperately trying to find pieces of information that I can identify with as I was growing up, I would have held on to those things, and right. I never saw it. And so, you know, you see, courses, you know, trying to pull in bits of Indigenous content, and you know, with the new curriculum requiring, you know, Indigenous content to be throughout K to 12, all subject areas, you know, there isn't a lot of support for teachers to do that. But oftentimes what I see being done is little bits of tokenized information being placed in there. And, you know, while that's something, it's something certainly evolved from, you know, when I went to school, I don't think that really provides the information that students need in order to understand these two different and complementary paradigms. And right. So, you know, when I'm, you know, I imagine myself going to school and not even having any kind of counter narrative to this Eurocentric, you know, science model, I feel like the changes that I would like to see are having these different paradigms being expressed equally.
Right.
And, you know, not in a tokenized way, not in like a little aside piece, okay, we've ticked our box, but really getting down to, you know, what is an Indigenous paradigm? Let's talk about that idea of connectivity and respect and reciprocity, and lay that groundwork first before bringing in content. You know, so if you're talking about conservation, you know, just throwing in, oh, and the Inuit people say this. Let's get down to why it is that what they're saying is important.
Right.
And so, you know, and I don't think that taking less time talking about, you know, the Western science model and taking some of that time and really pulling in authentic Indigenous content, I don't think that takes away from the course as a whole. I actually think it makes it stronger.
I totally agree with that. And I think you're absolutely right about that, you know, we need to start this education not necessarily within science, but just within schools in general.
Absolutely.
And that way we can see, you know, hopefully teachers will be able to help their students see how that connects everything across all of the subject areas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to your point, too, about the, you know, why the Inuit know what they do about mm-hmm. the land, it's mm-hmm. because they live on the land and observe the land. Yeah. I know you've been working a little bit with land-based education mm-hmm. in Saskatchewan. Can mm-hmm. you share a little about that as well?
Well, I mean, the Indigenous paradigm is all about the participation with nature,
right.
The interaction with nature, that we are not separate from it. You know, whereas the Eurocentric style of or model of science is about objective observation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we are separate from this system. We are, you know, a hovering body looking down at this, and you know, there's definitely value in that objectivity in certain, you know, aspects of science, but there's also a deeply important aspect of that participation and that deep connection to a place, that deep knowing of a place, that I think is really undervalued. So in being able to teach courses out on the land and getting out of the classroom, you know, we're able to not just talk about an Indigenous paradigm.
Right.
We're able to actually live it and be it. And, you know, we can weave ceremony and spirituality into these science courses that we teach. And we, you know, we bring in local Indigenous knowledge keepers and, you know, whether these students are Indigenous or not, it really creates a model for them to, you know, to see the value of getting students out of these four walls and actually out onto the land, because, you know, we can talk about the land and we can talk about the plants and we can talk about all of these things, but if you're not sitting there and feeling the wind and smelling the flowers and hearing the birds and able to see how they're all actually interacting in a very choreographed, beautiful way, you can't really understand. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being able to be out on the land and share that space with the students and with the knowledge keepers and, you know, with the animals and with the plants, it's really something transformational, not only for me as an instructor, but also for the students.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most exciting aspects of your work, and something that I really hope that we'll see more of within teacher education programs to mm-hmm. prepare mm-hmm. student teachers to go out in the world and have these different dispositions about what good teaching and learning means.
Yeah.
And I think those connections to the land are going to be, you know, what saves us in the end.
If Absolutely.
If we recognize, and I also like that phrase, we belong to the land, mm-hmm. not that the land belongs to
Absolutely.
Us. So once we begin to recognize that, I think there's a lot more hope for the future.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're a cog in the wheel, you
yeah.
know, of this whole system that the earth has provided for us. And I think it's important to remember that.
Yeah. As I was preparing for this interview with Lindsay, I was reading some work by another Indigenous scientist. Robin Wall Kimmerer is a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation and a decorated scholar in plant biology. Her most recent book, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teaching of Plants, is an excellent example of how we might weave Indigenous and Western science together. In it, she writes with equal amounts of beautifully crafted prose and hard biological facts about the relationships between plants and humans and between plants and one another. In one chapter, structured with the classical headings of a thesis or dissertation, she writes about the master's research carried out by one of her students on the best way to harvest sweetgrass. Kimmerer describes learning differing teachings on the correct way to harvest from two different elders, although they did agree that you should never harvest more than half of whatever it is you're collecting. This difference of opinion on traditional ecological knowledge and methods led to the suggestion that her student take up this topic as a formal study. Upon presenting the study proposal to a panel of faculty members, Kimmerer's grad student encountered resistance to the notion that Indigenous knowledge and ways of knowing could in any way inform scientific discourse. As the chapter continues, Kimmerer describes the careful control groups her student created to test the impact of each harvesting method, including one completely unharvested patch for comparison. In the study results, the presentation of which ultimately won over her previously resistant colleagues, it was determined that there is indeed a symbiotic relationship between humans and sweetgrass, as both harvesting methods produced lushly robust crops, while the unharvested patch failed to thrive. Her point, and I think this is one that Lindsay shares, is that Indigenous knowledges are often arrived at through a consideration of the interconnectedness of things and trial and error over time. The elders who taught her about sweetgrass harvesting knew the rules and protocols that had been passed down to them and rooted in the surety that all things are interrelated and interdependent. Kimmerer's colleagues were won over because a Western scientific method was used to prove that the elders were correct. Did this change their thinking about the inclusion of Indigenous ways of knowing in scientific discourses? Probably not, but it could. In the same year that Kimmerer's book was published, 2013, Cree scholar Dr. Herman Michel also published a book on science and Indigenous perspectives. In Cree Ways of Knowing and School Science, he discusses the same ontological differences in the two ways of thinking that I described at the beginning of this episode, and that are made clear in both Lindsay Heller's and Robin Kimmerer's work. And that word that Lindsay used, Wakotowin, is an important part of his work.
Michelle seeks to forge pathways to understanding for science educators who have often have to fight against the disengagement of Indigenous students. He points out that the issue is not that the students lack interest in learning, but that they, and many other students, need to see the relationship between what they're learning and everyday life. The learning has to be grounded. Further along in his discussion, Michelle asserts that there is no Cree word for science. The closest approximation is Pimetiwisin, the Cree word for life. This is important because it sets the stage for the Cree worldview. We are all in this together. Plants, humans, animals, water, earth, and air. And no one thing is more important than any other. But all are in relationship with one another. Kimmerer knows plants on a molecular level, as does Heller. But both of them are able to see plants in relationship to everything around them as well. Perhaps that's the biggest difference between Western and Indigenous ways of knowing. Sometimes in the West, we forget to see that everything is connected. Our little blue ball is a closed system, more or less, so we really are all in this together, and it would benefit us all to see it that way. Indigenizing science education is less about pitting Indigenous and Western ways of knowing against one another, and more about learning to see not just things and phenomena, but the relationships between things and phenomena. Remember the premise of two-eyed seeing I said in the first episode? Through their work, Lindsay Heller, Robin Kimmerer, and Herman Michelle show us how this is possible. Well, that's it for episode 3. Thanks, as always, to our producer and sound magician, Aaron Green, and thanks to the fabulous folks at CITR for hosting us. We hope you'll tune in again. And if you have ideas for future episodes, look for us on Facebook or at thesituationofeducation.com. Class dismissed.